Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. Anyone who is standing may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions this morning. Our first case is State versus Malone. I am Mike Hadiken, the Chief Justice, and by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
John Epic.
And John Friedenberg.
And Mr. Supernar, are you on this morning?
He's muted.
I apologize. Yes, you are.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Vincent, are you on this morning?
I am.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin arguments this morning?
No, sir.
No, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Supernaw. Again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Bradley Supernaw of the Boucher Law Firm on behalf of appellant Mr. Kevin Malone. Mr. Malone is currently serving a 50-year sentence for vehicular homicide, along with a couple of other charges. At trial, Mr. Malone was deprived of his right of effective assistance of counsel on several issues. And there is also an issue with the completeness of the Bill of Exceptions that was used on the direct appeal. Mr. Malone was represented at trial and on direct appeal by the same attorney, who was also ineffective as appellate counsel. Among the issues on the effective assistance of counsel, the trial counsel failed to present testimony and evidence that would have shown that the decedent, Mr. Hart, was the cause of the accident and the cause of his own death. The trial counsel had hired Dr. Ted Sokol, a respected accident reconstructionist, to reconstruct the accident. It was Mr. Sokol's conclusion that absent Mr. Hart's action, there would not have been an accident at all. That Mr. Hart failed to properly apply his brakes and instead laying the vehicle, laying the motorcycle on its side was the cause of the accident. The reason that the trial counsel gave for not calling Dr. Sokol was that he did not want to make Mr. Hart look bad. That's what he told Mr. Malone. The trial counsel was also ineffective in the cross-examination of Officer Kelly, who was the main prosecuting witness. Officer Kelly was the officer who did the DRE and made several conflicting statements during his testimony, none of which were brought up by the trial counsel.
Mr. Supernaw, what is this court's standard of review for the trial court's determinations on these matters?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not quite sure. I believe it may be plain error. Continuing on with the ineffective assistance of counsel, Trial counsel had a conflict of interest that he did not notify Mr. Malone of or several months into representing Mr. Malone. There was not a proper hearing on the issue.
What does the record tell us about that?
It was a very brief exchange. Basically, the judge asked if Mr. Malone had discussed it, the conflict with his trial counsel, and whether he was okay to proceed. As court and State v. Cotton kind of laid out what is necessary for to waive the conflict of interest, it must be knowing and intelligent. Not only does the defendant need to be aware of the conflict, but needs to be aware of the concerns that the impact the conflict may have on his representation.
What more needs to happen here?
Again, there was a very brief, did your counsel know of this? Are you okay to proceed? There was nothing indicating that Mr. Malone had been made aware of the impact the conflict may have on the representation, or that he had been able to ask his counsel question.
Was this a timing issue, as in he found out too late in the process and he couldn't hire a new counsel, or was that a concern?
That was a concern at that point. I believe it had been 3 months. Mr. Malone had already paid his trial counsel, I believe, $25,000. And there had been a lot of work done on the case at that point. Mr. Malone was also deprived of due process through prosecutorial misconduct, as well as misconduct by the police officers in their testimony. This was not raised on direct appeal by the appellate counsel, which was again the same as the trial counsel, nor did trial counsel object to any of these statements. For example, the prosecuting attorney, Mr. Lindberg, when talking about Malone's testimony, told the jury that it was ridiculous and that Mr. Malone had woven a story. It wasn't couched in, well, it seems like he may have woven a story. It was just made as a statement of fact that he woke the story. According to State v. Hernandez, it is improper for the prosecuting attorney to make his opinions about the credibility of the defendant, because it induces the jury to believe the prosecutor and take on the prosecutor's view of the defendant's credibility. Basically, it usurps the role of the jury in determining the credibility of the witness. During the closing, Mr. Lindberg also usurped the role of the jury as the fact finder by saying, this is what we know. It wasn't just characterizing the testimony. He wasn't saying this is what was testified to. He was saying this is what we know, and then stating facts. Many of the facts that Mr. Lindberg stated were just not were contradicted by testimony at trial. For example, Mr. Lindberg said that Mr. Malone was not part of the Good Samaritans trying to save the life of Joseph Hart. He said that Mr. Malone did not try to render aid, that Mr. Malone failed to identify himself. All of those were contradicted and stated as matters of fact.
Mr. Supernaw, I want to direct your attention to your argument about the sufficiency of the record in the 2-105 hearing. Do you have a constitutional argument, for example, to be able to hear whatever tape was made of the trial and the testimony with your client?
No, there's not a constitutional argument to be able to hear the audio recordings. However, there is, you know, for a proper appeal, a complete record is needed. And this court has said in Hines v. Good Samaritan Hospital that if there's a deficient record that's not the caused by the appellant, that the case will be remanded for a new trial. And in this case, there was the testimony of four people who were present at the trial who said that they heard an exchange between Mr. Malone and Mr. Lindberg that did not appear in the transcript. Mr. Malone recalls two other instances. These are instances that also were other examples of prosecutorial misconduct. For example, Mr. Lindberg saying that, you know, you don't expect us to believe what you just said, basically. And at the 2105 hearing, the judge basically ignored all of the testimony. There was no testimony that that didn't occur. Mr. Lindberg testified, but he basically said that he couldn't remember. The judge ignored the testimony and instead relied on hearsay statement by her court reporter, who, you know, was given the opportunity to review the audio files, and which was specifically denied as an exhibit by Judge Stratman. And as appellate courts have stated that have criticized in the past when those were not made as an exhibit in a 2105 hearing.
Counsel, how should we characterize the process by which the Court of Appeals sent this to the district court to conduct that 2105 hearing? Was it a remand? Was it something other than a remand?
It was not a complete remand. They basically, if I recall correctly, and I apologize, I haven't put that order for several months. They just sent it back down to the trial court to conduct the 2105 hearing. They didn't relinquish jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals did not relinquish jurisdiction over the case.
Mr. Pernod, did any of the parties to the case file a motion in the district court for a hearing under 2-105?
Yeah, there were several motions, some of them made pro se by Mr. Malone, to correct the record and for a 2105 hearing. Those were denied by the trial judge.
We have case law and a lot of case law that says that an appellate court and a trial court do not or cannot exercise jurisdiction over the substantive merits of a case at the same time. We also have case law that says that when an appeal is pending in the appellate court with respect to the Bill of Exceptions, the trial court acts only in a ministerial capacity to certify the record. What authority was there for the Court of Appeals to, in essence, remand but not remand and make a determination that the record was insufficient, disposing of the entire case, in other words?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that last bit?
Without disposing of the entire appeal.
Okay. Well, what, as you just mentioned, the correcting the record is a ministerial rather than a substantive. So the Court of Appeals still has the substantive jurisdiction over the case, but was asking the trial court to do something that would be ministerial.
So did the trial court do that?
It did, but not properly, not effectively. Again, by relying not on the testimony that was presented, but relying on the hearsay of the court reporter, and by relying on an exhibit that wasn't was requested but was not, that was denied as an exhibit in the hearing.
We have case law that says the trial record imports absolute verity. What is this notion that you can just bring in witnesses and impeach the trial record? I'm not familiar with case law that suggests you can do that. Do you have any authority for that proposition?
Well, there is, of course, the court rules 2105. And there have been, for example, in State versus Case, instances where there were hearings and there were witnesses who testified at the hearings. I don't know if they were eyewitnesses to the trial or if they were, you know, participants in the trial.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
She's muted.
You're muted.
We can't hear you anyway.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent and I represent the Appalachia, the state of Nebraska. I will address the bill of exceptions issue first, since I believe that's the main reason why we're here. If time permits, I will specifically address three of Malone's post-conviction claims and submit the others on the brief, unless, of course, this court has questions. By way of background, prior to the Rule 105 hearing, Malone subpoenaed Bellamy to testify. However, due to an incorrect address, the subpoena did not get served, Bellamy did not appear, and Malone did not request a continuance to secure her appearance. Instead, he attempted to offer into evidence the audio recording from his trial, and the district court said no. The court noted that the existing BOE had been previously certified as the official court record, and that the purpose of this hearing was to give Malone an opportunity to present evidence showing that the BOE was incomplete. Because Malone did not call Bellamy as a witness, he presented no evidence as to how she prepared the BOE or the procedures that she used to ensure its accuracy. Instead, he offered his own testimony, the testimony of three family members, which corroborated his testimony, but only in part, the prosecutor's testimony, which did not help him, and his private investigator's affidavit, which also did not help him. Following the hearing, the district court asked Stratton to compare the audio recording to the BOE to confirm its assumption that the two matched. Stratton then executed an affidavit to that effect, which the court attached to his order denying Malone's motion. Which brings us to Malone's assignment of error. He claims the district court erred by relying solely on Stratton's affidavit and for further denying him an opportunity to cross-examine Stratton. I disagree on both counts. First, the district court did not rely solely on the affidavit. Rather, its order specifically mentions the evidence received at the hearing. Furthermore, Stratton's affidavit merely confirmed what the district court had already assumed, namely that the recording matched the BOE. Second, Stratton was no substitute for Bellamy. She was not the court reporter at Malone's trial. She did not prepare the trial record. What she said in her affidavit was the only thing that she could say. I compared these two things and they match. Because she knew nothing else about this BOE or how it was prepared, there would have been little utility in cross-examining her. The only remaining question here is whether the evidence Malone presented was sufficient to justify the amendment. And I submit the answer to that question is no, for the reasons that I have argued in my brief. I don't believe any of these exchanges occurred, and even if they did, we don't know whether McGann objected to them. But in any event, yes.
Does someone who is in Mr. Malone's position have some kind of constitutional right to hear the tape that the court reporter made?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, if there is one, I would assume that it's probably in the due process clause, but you know, I would imagine that I think that's covered pretty much by the BOE, you know, the requirement that we actually have an accurate transcription of those recordings, but we entrust that responsibility to court reporters who have special education. They have to, you know, they have to pass proficiency exams. They take an oath of office. So, you know, I think they have a right to access the record. I'm not sure that they have a right to access things like stenographer's notes or recordings of things that were actually, you know, used to prepare that record, unless they can make some sort of a substantial showing that it's necessary. And I don't think he met that in this case. And frankly, I don't think you can meet it in any case where you haven't bothered to call the court reporter as a witness.
what would someone need to show to the district court judge that they deserve to hear the tape that was made?
You know, that's a good question, and I've asked myself that same question a number of times. And
you well, know, let's do it. Let's do it hypothetically. What if the state wanted to hear the tape that was made?
Well, I would assume the same rules apply. I mean, what applies for defendants would probably apply equally to the state, and that's why I think part of what's so important here is that we actually have the court reporter, because it's possible that you could get some testimony from the court reporter that would suggest that something went wrong. So, for example, in this case, I would assume that if, when Ms. Bellamy was preparing the record in this case, that if there was some sort of mechanical failure, her equipment malfunctioned, we wouldn't have just, you know, testimony dropping out at the beginning and end of an exchange. It wouldn't be neat. It would have cut in and out at various points. We would have had people cut off mid-sentence. She would have been alerted to those things. Or if she was aware that she was having some other difficulty, excuse me, with her machine or some other problem that, you know, might lend credence to that. But again, if it's not on the recording, it's not on the recording. So I think in this situation, it's difficult to say, well, gee, I think something's missing, or I remember something else being there that isn't there. But, you know, I've had two court reporters listen to the same recording and say, no, this is all there is.
I beg your pardon. Is there a possibility of evidence, and I leave it to you to determine by whom, with respect to the limitations of the audio, so that it might not pick up an exchange, finish the sentence at a distance, or, you know, under their breath, or
sure,
so forth? And how would that limitation that could suggest a deficiency of the audio be explored?
Well, I think that's where the stenographer notes would become very important. And I don't know a lot about court reporting, to be fair. You know, usually I do appellate work, and what I get is the bill of exceptions, and that's all I work with. But, you know, as a practical matter, if you have a stenographer or a court reporter there who's taking down notes, and then you have a backup recording that's also picking things up, you're basically recording these proceedings on two tracks, and they operate as a check on themselves. Because one of the reasons I would imagine that you want a court reporter is because there are certain nuances or things that maybe the court reporter could pick up or ask for clarification on that we don't necessarily get on the audio. So I think that's why the importance of having those two things and cross-referencing them when the court reporter is actually preparing the record is so important. But that's certainly an issue if there's something that, did, for whatever reason, just didn't get picked up on the audio, but the court reporter picked it up on her stenographer's notes, which again simply illustrates the importance of her testimony at a hearing of this nature.
Is there a reason not to make the audio available other than the rule doesn't call for it?
Well, you know, I wasn't involved with the mandamus action. I'm aware of it. I did watch the oral argument in that case, and I know that our SG, Mr. Campbell, gave some reasons for that apparently these SD cards can contain up to a year's worth of hearings, that they pick up virtually everything. It doesn't just stop and start with the court proceedings. It picks up private conversations between court, you know, the district court, the court staff, the attorneys, the state's attorneys, and those sorts of things. And so, you know, instead of having the, I don't know, I'm not technically savvy enough to know whether you can winnow those things down or how much of a process that is, but I would imagine that, you know, if the court has determined that the bill of exceptions is the official record, and that's what becomes public, that's what the parties rely on, and that the custody of the stenography notes and the recordings remain with the court reporter, that those aren't for public consumption. Those are to prepare recordings. They're not meant to be just widely distributed to anyone who wants them. Otherwise, why don't we just file the whole thing together? Why don't you just file the bill of exceptions along with the stenographer's notes and, you know, the hearing, so you can, with the recording, so you can just let them listen to everything. It's all public records. And again, I don't know enough about public records and that to say whether they should be or not, but that's my understanding of why we don't just make it available. It might not be technically feasible or easy to do.
Ms. Vincent, this particular reporter was a stenographic reporter who used an audio recording as a backup.
Yes.
If we were to enable anyone and everyone to have access to these backup recordings, wouldn't that have the perverse incentive of suggesting to stenographic reporters that they not use a backup, but they simply rely exclusively on their notes?
Potentially, sure, if you don't want to have to give up access to those. I mean, the whole premise here, and I think the gist of his claim, at least as I understand it, he hasn't really fully articulated. I got a hint of it at the hearing when Moreland testified, is that he's alleging malfeasance on behalf of his court reporter. That she somehow went in and sanitized this record, possibly in collusion with the prosecutor in this case. And so if that's what you're concerned about, is that somebody's going to come in and say, okay, well, there's something on there and you're deliberately leaving this off, then maybe they don't. Maybe they just go solely with their stenographer's notes, and the only thing that you can challenge is what happens to be there. And so it could, you know, create a disincentive, and I don't think that's something that we want to do, because it's kind of nice to have that extra reporting there to ensure the accuracy, I think, is applicable to have the goal.
Well, couldn't this court simply make a rule that if there had to be a recording made in preserve?
Sure, I think so. I mean, that authority has been relegated to this court by statute, so yes, I think you could do that. I think you could also declare whether these, you know, are publicly available or not, unless, you know, for some reason, I guess there's still that issue out there about whether the public record, since that was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. But I would assume that the court could do that by rule, that it has the authority.
And some of these issues were suggested in the mandamus, but we didn't get that far. Isn't that correct?
Right. Yes.
Practically speaking, if we allow the recording to come in, or if you have access to it as well, wouldn't ultimately the recording end up being the official BOE? Because if there was ever a discrepancy between the two, the recording would be the tiebreaker, wouldn't it?
Well, I would assume so, unless, as Justice Miller-Lerman pointed out, there might be some.
Well, the judge ultimately has to be the tiebreaker here. Doesn't she?
I would assume so. And of course, you know, you always have a problem with recordings, because we sometimes have this with interviews and that sort of thing. Whenever you have audio files, that some things are just, you know, unintelligible for whatever reason. And then you have to basically rely on the court report. So I don't think you come up with a hard and fast rule as to which one trumps the other one, unless it's clear. But again, I think the district court would be the tiebreaker in that instance. I think that would be entrusted to them.
Before you go, I think your time is largely up, but can you help us a little bit about where we are with jurisdiction? We have two appeals here. What is your take or input on that?
Well, I think the position that we took initially, because he tried to appeal from the court's order in this particular case, the BOE case, the 460. And I think the position that we took is the Court of Appeals consolidated the two of them, and we believe that it was just that this was like a separate issue, essentially, in his post-conviction case. I don't know that that's a final order. I haven't really walked through that analysis, but that's the way I view it, is just it's just another component of this particular appeal. If it's separate, then maybe there is a jurisdictional issue. Maybe it's not a final order. Although it's hard to say, it doesn't affect the substantial right, potentially. So I'm not sure to answer your question. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments in State versus Malone. Thank you, counsel, for both of you for participating on WebEx. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Champion versus Hall County, Nebraska.